Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 124. It's October 22nd, 2020. There's been so little clear thinking about the role of violence in history that a bibliography of megapolitical analysis could be written on a single sheet of paper. In The Great Reckoning, we drew upon and elaborated arguments of an almost entirely forgotten classic of megapolitical analysis, William Playfair's An Inquiry into the Permanent Causes of the Decline and Fall of Powerful and Wealthy Nations, published in 1805. Here one of our departure points is the work of Frederick C. Lane. Lane was a medieval historian who wrote several penetrating essays on the role of violence in history during the 1940s and 50s. Perhaps the most comprehensive of these was Economic Consequences of Organized Violence, which appeared in the Journal of Economic History in 1958. Few people other than professional economists and historians have read it, and most of them seem not to have recognized its significance. Like Playfair, Lane wrote for an audience that did not yet exist. Lane published his work on violence and the economic meaning of war well before the advent of the information age. He certainly was not writing in anticipation of microprocessing or the other technological revolutions now unfolding. Yet his insights into violence established a framework for understanding how society will be reconfigured in the information revolution. The window Lane opened into the future was one through which he peered into the past. He was a medieval historian, and particularly a historian of a trading city, Venice, whose fortunes surged and sagged in a violent world. In thinking about how Venice rose and fell, his attention was attracted to issues that can help you understand the future. He saw the fact that how violence is organized and controlled plays a large role in determining what uses are made of scarce resources. We believe that Lane's analyses of the competitive uses of violence has much to tell us about how life is likely to change in the information age. But don't expect most people to notice, much less follow, some unfashionably abstract an argument. While the attention of the world is riveted on dishonest debates and wayward personalities, the meanderings of megapolitics continue almost unnoted. The average North American has probably lavished 100 times more attention on O.J. Simpson and Monica Lewinsky than he has on the new microtechnologies that are poised to antiquate his job and subvert the political system he depends on for unemployment compensation. With events unfolding many times faster than during previous transformations, early understanding of how the world will change could turn out to be far more useful to you than it would have been to your ancestors at an equivalent juncture in the past. Even if the first farmers had miraculously understood the full megapolitical implications of tilling the earth, this information would have been practically useless, because thousands of years were to pass before the transition to the new phase of society was complete. Not so today. History is sped up. Forecasts that correctly anticipate the megapolitical implications of new technology are likely to be far more useful today. If we can develop the implications of the current transition to the information society to the same extent that someone with current knowledge could have grasped the implications of past transitions to farm and factory, that information should be many times more valuable now. Put simply, the action horizon for megapolitical forecasts has shrunk to its most useful range within the span of a single lifetime. And quoting Frederick Lane, looking back over the centuries, or even if only at the present, we can clearly observe that many men have made their living, often a very good living, from their special skill in applying weapons of violence, and that their activities have had a very large part in determining what uses were made of scarce resources. Our study of megapolitics is an attempt to do just that, to draw out the implications of the changing factors that alter the boundaries where violence is exercised. These megapolitical factors largely determine when and where violence pays. They also help inform the market distribution of income. As economic historian Frederick Lane so clearly put, how violence is organized and controlled plays a large role in determining what uses are made of scarce resources. In almost every competitive arena, including most of the world's multi-trillion dollar investment activity, the migration of transactions into cyberspace will be driven by an almost hydraulic pressure, the impetus to avoid predatory taxation, including the tax that inflation places upon everyone who holds his wealth in a national currency. You do not need to think long about the megapolitics of the information age to realize that predatory taxes and inflation of the kind imposed as a matter of right by the wealthiest industrial countries upon their citizens will be preposterously uncompetitive on the new frontier of cyberspace. Soon after the turn of the millennium, anyone who pays income taxes at rates currently imposed will be doing so out of choice. As Frederick C. Lane pointed out, history shows that on the frontiers and on the high seas, where no one had an enduring monopoly in the use of violence, merchants avoided payment of exactions which were so high that protection could be obtained more cheaply by other means. The cyber economy provides just such an alternative. No government will be able to monopolize it, and the information technologies comprised by it will provide cheaper and more effective protection for financial assets than most governments ever had reason to provide. Remember, each $5,000 of annual tax payments paid over 40 years slashes your net worth by $2.2 million, assuming you could realize just a 10% return on your capital. At a 20% return, the compound loss balloons to about $44 million. For high-income earners in a high-tax country, the cumulative losses from predatory taxation over a lifetime are staggering. Most will lose more than they ever had. Those are selections from three parts of The Sovereign Individual, Mastering the Transition to the Information Age, co-written by James Dale Davidson and Lord William Rees-Mogg, who also co-authored The Great Reckoning. This book came out in 1997. And so you got references to O.J. Simpson and Monica Lewinsky that are clearly from that time. Though, references to debates and silly political personalities are pretty evergreen. O.J. Simpson and Monica Lewinsky stand out. These two essays, which I think are online, they're old enough, I think, to be in the public domain, that they cite about from William Playfair in 1805 and Frederick C. Lane in the 50s, they're interesting. Touched just briefly in one of these recently, one of these dispatches, on Eric Barnow's beginning of his three-volume set on the history of broadcasting in the United States from founding up to about 1970 when the third volume was published. And he makes the claim there that changes in media change society, change values, change the exchange of value. They simply reorganize society, papyrus, parchment, paper, print, these kinds of things. And imagine now it's sort of the McLuhan perfectly realized global village and all of this, the web, the worldwide web and all facets. Here in The Sovereign Individual, they also situate very much around what are the economies of scale available to the technologies of violence at any given point in history. So the radical change that is wrought in the Iron Age, feudalism exists in the Iron Age when violence could only subjugate a limited trade radius, if you will. There's a limited trade radius for violence. There weren't nation states yet because you couldn't, they just couldn't be managed. It took rail and flight and telecommunications and all manner of stuff to make that possible. And their point really is that the information age, a term, probably still pretty popular in the late 90s and being forecasted into the future. Here we are well removed from that point already. Would radically change that. Imagine too, in the past, try to imagine just even World War II, like the dropping of leaflets and the broadcast of radio messages to try to reach a population that you're at war with and get some sort of message out versus today where there's all this legitimate and also simultaneously overblown panic about foreign influence and this and that. And there's all these sock puppet accounts and who knows who's behind what on Twitter, for example. It's confusing as a human to be alive right now. And I think they're right. I think everybody's realizing like the pace of change is accelerating, converging so many arenas of life. And we get so much input now, so much noise. But already, like I'm sitting here in Austin, Texas, I know plenty of people who've moved here from California and similar places expressly to avoid state income taxes in California. They can move here. First of all, there's kind of a a step down in per square foot of land prices and that kind of thing. It's not as expensive, though it is expensive in Austin. It's not as expensive as it is in San Francisco or Los Angeles. But not only that, like if you have a decent income, a high income, and you just don't owe California anymore, that's a tremendous amount of money to you year after year after year. I hear tell of stories where something like, say, Chicago in nearby Wisconsin, one jurisdiction has a sales tax and no income tax, and the other jurisdiction is the reverse. So what do people do? If they can, they live on one side of the line where they don't have to pay income tax. They do their shopping on the other side of the line where they don't pay sales tax, things like that. And on an international basis, we see stories from time to time. We know that companies locate their headquarters where it advantages their tax treatments. And so you have things like Amazon can reinvest its profits and people get all up in arms about its revenues, even profits, but it's got probably, I don't even know the details. It has a carry loss forward or what. It pays very little in current income taxes. This president paying very little in current income taxes, supposedly the last couple of years. Who knows? Do we have the complete comprehensive picture? Who knows? But that's sort of built into the system, isn't it? That you can have losses and the tax code is so preposterously Byzantine and gigantic that it represents thousands upon thousands of political compromises and behavior, the intent on behavior modification. So it's encouraging this and that and discouraging this and that. And are there loopholes? Sure, there's loopholes that you can, as it were, drive a semi-truck full of money through. And the people with the means avail themselves of those gaps and holes. And now, what's interesting, in this book, if memory serves, they go through and talk about like how the Iron Age, you know, brought feudalism, and then gunpowder comes along, and then, you know, eventually nuclear weapons appear, and now the entire world is coded in nation states. You can look at a globe or National Geographic Atlas, and the color-shaded regions apply to every last square foot of the earth. And of course, the prevailing powers at the time when these things emerge all sit around tables and smoke their cigars and negotiate for who has what right to what spot of land, all that sort of thing. The book, while diving through history, is also making certain claims about the future, what's going to happen. And one of the things they were talking about in 97, and Osama bin Laden was a known figure at the time. He is mentioned in the book, but they're talking about how the economies of scale available to the technologies of violence have radically changed, and small clusters of non-state actors will be able to use these communication tools to organize and steer massively damaging, punishing, destroying bouts of violence. And I think that's obviously come to fruition. And they spend a significant amount of time talking about, speculating then at the time, this wasn't very far along, about, they would use the term then, I think, cyber currency. We don't really talk about it. I don't know that that word gets used. Cyber has kind of fallen out of favor as a prefix. Nonetheless, they're talking about these principles. And, you know, the two have gone hand in hand, have they not? That states have a monopoly on the official use of violence, the right of incarceration, sometimes the right of execution, you know, and certainly a defense department that can wage war against the defense departments of other nations, that kind of thing. But the state has monopoly power over violence over its own citizenry, really. They're charged with a certain duties that private citizens just can't do otherwise, and states have monopoly control over their currencies, can decide if and how, what can be used to pay taxes. You know, you have to pay your taxes in dollars, basically, inside the United States. All of this. But since this book came out in 97, well, Bitcoin came out. All kinds of things have changed. And I don't know. I don't have any answers. I don't even know if this book is especially great, by the way. There's other areas where they've kind of been making some claims that haven't, they either seem off track or they haven't proved out yet. And that's to be expected, I suppose. But I've always, I read it back way back when, I don't know, in the late 90s, I suppose. And it stuck with me. their call about some of these explosive, terrible bouts of terrorism and other violence, and their call for cyber currencies and a freedom of movement of capital and people, they would make it very challenging for the states, because the states in response, they argued, would surveil more. They would use the powers to eavesdrop on everything that's moving across these networks. And that would further alienate the citizens. And so there would just be this interesting, difficult dance. And I think we're living through that, Snowden and all manner of, I mean, there's just a giant sea of this that's going on. But the stuff that's talked about in The Sovereign Individual and talking about they sort of using these older essays to say they're situating some of their thinking, they're extrapolating on teasing out what technologies are available to enact violence and who can control those technologies and therefore control certain other facets of society. That they take that as an organizing principle, the swords, if you will. And Eric Barnow talking about media and really getting under the hood into the history of media and talking about the why. Why did it evolve this way in particular in the U.S. and other places and technologically, and that's the pen. And so they're just, it's interesting. The pen is mightier than the sword, and it's very interesting these days, the tools that the surveillance, staffers have that we all participate in voluntarily now, compared to, say, the 1950s. If you want to know what everybody's doing now, I mean, we just share publicly on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and everything else, all manner of data about us. We have these, you know, Alexas listening to everything we do, and we're just surveilled all the time. It's a panopticon of endless sea of being surveilled. That's pretty fascinating. And the ability to reach across borders with messages, it's very dizzying, is it not? There's an awareness, a much greater awareness within a given town and neighborhood, but also around the world, of any atrocity, injustice, real, perceived, faked, or otherwise. So there's just a dizzying amount of information, and sometimes bad actors sort of lurking inside there and running all kinds of other who knows what campaigns that just mystify us all. And if you try to keep up with the quote news, it's going to drive you crazy. There's too much of it. It gets rewritten all the time. We don't allow enough time for them to, the so-called journalists, to even do their job. And these days they seem to have abandoned what we classically associate as their job with this strange kind of PR shilling for one partisan cause or another. So it's just very, very strange. But the pen is mightier than the sword. All that's going on the pen side, all that's going on the sword side, I find very fascinating. We all live within it. It's easy to not see. And it's kind of slowly, I think, agitating us all. If you're not careful, there's sort of an anxiety to it. Because I think they're right that the pace of change has accelerated. There's so much that's converging here. So anyway, I don't have any answers. I just think that there are some of their stuff. Their passages are kind of cool. And I'll link to those old essays, if I can find them again, in the show notes. So you can go down there too. And maybe I'll read from, you know, some of them as well sometime soon. Hope it gets you thinking. And hope everything's well. Talk to you soon. Thanks.